The Traitress, Sidney Haller. That dull red stain was blood. The realization came swiftly to Chertsey as he stood, uncomfortable and bewildered, in the center of the room. At his feet was a murdered man. Baintree, clad in evening dress, lay perfectly still. His arms were outflung and his legs were supine. Their limpness was so horribly grotesque they might have belonged to a giant doll. In Baintree's breast was the wound which the assassin had made. The stiff white shirt was ugly with it. With a shudder, Chertsey remembered that some of that lifeblood was on his hand. He looked round. He did not deny that he was nervous, very nervous. One had to live through an ordeal like this to know how deeply one could be stirred. The sight of the telephone on its stand in the far corner reminded him of things outside, of the police. In such a case, one always telephoned for the police. He was suddenly filled with dread, with that blood on his hand. 30 yards away in Piccadilly, a taxicab passed with hooting of horn. Inside this room, there was a deep, immovable stillness, the uncanny silence of death. It began to frighten him. He felt he could not stand it any longer. Whatever discomfiture the action might bring, he must ring up the police. And then, as he took the first step across the carpet, the door opened and a man walked into the room. The suddenness of this man's appearance, following upon the tremendous shock he had just received, made him pull up with a start. And instantly, the thought came as he looked into the stranger's face that he must appear a guilty person. He certainly felt one. The stranger was calm and clear-headed, in the circumstances amazingly so. Keeping a steady gaze upon Chertsey, he quietly closed the door. After he had done this, his hand went into his pocket. It was withdrawn, holding a revolver. "Who are you?" It was a voice with a vibrant note, like the sound of steel cutting the air. It matched the speaker. Mesmerized by the behavior of the other, Chertsey continued to stare. He saw a thinnish man of perhaps 48, dressed in a dinner jacket suit beneath a light overcoat. Used to forming impressions, he swiftly summarized the man's face. The color of the flesh was gray, and every feature was grim. The thin, tight-locked lips, the challenging jut of the jaw, the angry blaze of the eyes. A granite man, this. "Who are you?" The demand was more peremptory this time.
"My name is Gilbert Chertsey."
"Profession?"
"I'm a novelist."
It seemed that the merest flicker of a smile passed over the other's stern mouth.
"A novelist? Well, what are you doing here?"
And then as Chertsey moved aside, "Put your hands over your head. No nonsense." When Chertsey hesitated, the other crossed to him with startling speed. The novelist had the incredible sensation of feeling a revolver thrust against his heart. He obeyed the bizarre command, conscious that the other man had noticed the bloodstain on his hand. The man said nothing, but his expression was significant. "Sit in that chair and tell me everything you know about this." He pointed with his left hand to the figure on the floor. "One moment." Kneeling, the speaker examined the body of Baintree. "Dead," he said.
"Yes."
The other showed his teeth.
"Who killed him?"
"I haven't the least idea. I can assure you I didn't. Possibly..."
"Possibly what?"
The Inquisitor had his deeply lined face out thrust. Chertsey felt himself hating the man almost as much as he feared him.
"Perhaps you will be good enough to tell me who you are," he said.
The thin lips parted in a mirthless smile.
"That can wait," was the reply.
"In the meantime, let me assure you, Mr. Chertsey, that I occupy a position which entitles me to take up my present attitude. Unless the explanation of your presence in this flat is thoroughly satisfying, I shall have you immediately arrested. What is that on your hands? I must hear all of your movements tonight."
Chertsey pulled himself together. It was absurd to be afraid.
"I dined at the club."
"What club?"
"The Mayflower."
A nod.
"After dinner, a party of us played billiards and then went back to the smoking room to talk. Someone, Ringwood, I think, wanted to know if I was doing another novel. I said yes, but I wasn't getting on very fast."
"Where does this lead?"
Chertsey kept his temper.
"If you will excuse me," he replied, "I am coming to the point."
The other growled,
"Quickly then."
"I can fully understand that my work has no possible interest for you," commented the novelist. "But as it was my present book which brought me here tonight, I had to mention the fact. Mr. Robert Baintree was, I understand, a great traveller."
"Possibly."
Chertsey endeavoured to remain unruffled.
It was Ringwood, a friend of his, who sent me along to see Mr. Baintree tonight. Ringwood?
What Ringwood?
The Harley Street nerve specialist. He told me he was at Repington with Baintree.
Did he tell you anything else?
There was a snapped eagerness about the question. He said that Baintree knew Europe from one end to the other, and that if I wanted local colour for the Constantinople scenes in my new novel, he was the man to see. Ringwood was good enough to ring up Baintree and fix an appointment. I was to drop in here at 10:30 tonight.
And you kept this appointment?
I did. But I say, it's very disconcerting not to know to whom I am talking.
Don't let that affect you. Please continue your story. I find it very interesting.
It was impossible to decide if the man was being grimly facetious.
All right. I have already told you I kept the appointment. As a matter of fact, I was 5 minutes too early. When I entered the lift on the ground floor, I looked at my watch and saw that it was exactly 22 minutes past 10.
There was no one else in the lift.
No, I came up alone. Then...
Well? Growled the listener.
Chertsey winced. He was now reaching the crucial point of his narrative, and he realized that his conduct did not reflect the greatest credit on himself.
There is a small brass plate outside this flat door with Baintree on it. I rang the bell and waited, but no one came, and so I rang again. It was then that it happened.
What happened?
The listener was bending forward. The door suddenly opened and a man rushed out. A sharp intake of breath came from the direction of the other chair.
Describe him.
I'm afraid I can't. You see, he was past me in a flash.
Didn't you notice anything about him?
The inquiry was rasped.
Nothing, except that he had his overcoat collar turned up and that the upper part of his face was hidden by a soft felt hat turned down.
You didn't follow him?
Good God, man, why didn't you follow him? He had just committed a murder.
Look here, complained Chertsey. I'm not going on any longer unless I can put my hands down. For one thing, I want to smoke.
He lowered his hands without waiting for the permission and thrust them into his overcoat pockets. From these he drew out a pipe and tobacco pouch. The stain on the fingers was a horrible reminder, but he filled his pipe regardless of the revolver by which he was still menaced.
How was I to know the man was a murderer?
He had filled his pipe somewhat unsteadily, had it going by this time, and still kept his hands down.
Baintree was a stranger to me. It was no concern of mine if he entertained men who were eccentric enough to leave his flat as though the place was on fire. As a matter of fact, however ridiculous it may sound now, that was the thought which came to me. The flat was on fire and this man was rushing out to get assistance.
What about the telephone?
Chertsey shrugged. Of course, I have already said that it sounds ridiculous, but this is the first time I have actually come into contact with murder.
Lifting his hand, he found that his forehead was wet. The strain was beginning to tell.
Who was this questioner, and why did he not give him some hint of his identity?
He was tempted to make a rush for the door in spite of the revolver. After all, he was innocent. Why should he tolerate such treatment?
You did not disturb anything here.
Nothing. Let me finish. The fleeing man had left the flat door open. I walked inside. You understand I was vaguely suspicious. That was why I entered without ringing again. As I stepped into the hall, I called out, Mr. Baintree, but no answer came. Then I stepped into the first room I came to, this one.
Was the light on?
No, the room was in darkness. That strengthened the feeling I had that something was wrong, very wrong. I found the switch after a little while, and then I saw that. I knew it to be the body of the man I had come to see because Ringwood had described Baintree. At first, continued the novelist, I was bewildered, especially when, after stooping to examine how badly Baintree was injured, I found this, he held up his right hand, on my fingers. I realized that possibly I might be suspected of the crime myself, but I was just going to the telephone to ring up the police when you entered. What I have told you is the truth, he concluded.
The other rose.
You have withheld nothing.
Nothing.
Then, said the other, placing the revolver back into his pocket, you may go after giving me your address.
Where do you live?
128B Hartford Street, Mayfair, practically round the corner. With the receipt of this information, the other appeared to lose all interest in him.
Good night, Mr. Chertsey.
The novelist hesitated. He did not know if he were justified in leaving this man who refused to give any account of himself in the flat. The other spoke sharply.
There is one fact I must impress upon you before you go, Mr. Chertsey. It is that this affair tonight must not be discussed with anyone. It will be necessary for you to give me your promise on that point.
Chertsey bridled. You take a great deal for granted. I know absolutely nothing about you. Suppose I refuse? then believe me, you will find yourself in a somewhat uncomfortable position.
Oh, go to the devil!
His patience was exhausted. The interest which he had formerly experienced about this stranger had been replaced by annoyance. So exasperated that he felt he could not trust himself to say anything further, he opened the door. A minute later, he was in the street, walking rapidly towards his own rooms. It wasn't until the following morning that he found the thing. Going through the pockets of his evening kit, his fingers touched something soft. It proved to be a thin, black leather pocket case. As it did not belong to him, Chertsey was puzzled. Although he had no clear recollection on the point, the only conclusion to which he could come was that he must have found the case on the floor of the murder room the previous night and inadvertently placed it in his pocket. It had a clear connection with the crime, no doubt, and his first inclination was to open the case, but he overcame the desire. Directly after breakfast, he got into the taxi which had been ordered and gave an address, New Scotland Yard. The official to whose room he was conducted listened attentively to everything he said before picking up the case. He asked only one question.
"Do you know what this contains, Mr. Chertsey?"
"I do not. You see, it does not belong to me."
"Quite so. Well, thank you, Mr. Chertsey."
The speaker rose, intimating that the interview might be considered over. "I hope I did right in bringing it here."
"Certainly, you did quite right. Thank you once again."
If I had only known where to find the mysterious gentleman who cross-examined me last night in Mr. Baintree's flat, I would have gone to him.
Quite so.
Am I committing a breach of official etiquette in asking where that gentleman can be found? The Scotland Yard official walked to the door and held it open.
"I'd forget all about this affair if I were you," was his reply.
Chertsey stalked out. He would have been only too pleased to forget, but he could not dismiss the affair. He dealt professionally in mystery. His novels were of the shocker class, and the death of Robert Baintree contained all the elements to enchain a writer's attention. The escape of the supposed murderer, the finding of the body in that hushed room, the appearance of the unyielding, grim-visaged inquisitor, the peculiar reticence of the fellow at Scotland Yard, these were the circumstances which kept the tragedy fixed in his mind. It was the secrecy of the whole thing which was so baffling. Much as he hated the idea, he expected to be besieged by reporters, but none of the newspapers even printed the story of Robert Baintree's death. So far as any publicity was concerned, the tragedy might not have happened. More and more strange. That night he sought out Ringwood. The latter looked worried. Naturally enough, Chertsey commenced to talk about his experience. Long before he had finished his story, the Harley Street specialist, after glancing uneasily over his shoulder, and this was in the ultra-respectable atmosphere of the Mayflower Club, caught his arm.
"If I were you, old man, I'd forget everything about that business. Try to persuade yourself it never happened."
"What the devil are you talking about? Wasn't it through you that I went to see Baintree?"
"Yes, yes, but, well, the truth is, old man, I can't tell you what I know, and you'll have to be satisfied with that."
Chertsey looked at him squarely.
"Do you know who that man, Grimface, was?"
"Yes, I know."
"And you won't tell me?"
"I can't. Have another drink."
"To hell with you and your drinks."
Reaching home disgruntled and annoyed, his servant told him a gentleman was waiting.
"What's his name?"
"He didn't give any name, sir. I said you were certain to be home by 11, and he decided to wait."
"I don't exactly care for people who are afraid to give their names being allowed to wait in my rooms, Dixon."
"There's nothing suspicious about this gentleman, sir, but a very masterful type. He just brushed past me."
"Short, thin man?"
"Yes, sir. Very grey."
"Grimface."
So it proved.
"I called, Mr. Chertsey, to thank you for handing over that case to Scotland Yard. You did not look inside it, you say?"
"I made that statement to the official at Scotland Yard, and in the ordinary way I usually endeavour to speak the truth."
Grimface looked as though he contemplated a rebuke.
"Why did you not tell me about this case in the flat last night?" he went on.
"I say, excuse me not asking you before, but won't you have a drink?"
"I do not want a drink, thank you."
Chertsey continued to smile.
"I do wish you would have a drink. I'll tell you why. Before I insult a man, I always like to give him a drink."
"Do you intend to insult me?"
"I most certainly do. I'm going to answer one more question, the one you have just asked, and then I'm going to tell you to go to the devil. Do you imagine that I intend to spend the rest of my life being cross-examined by you? A man whose name I do not even know?"
"Now, for the answer.
I have no clear recollection of having picked up the black leather case which I took to Scotland Yard, but the strong probability is that I found it on the floor of the room in Baintree's flat and that I inadvertently placed it in my pocket. Now, do you mind going? You irritate me. For the first time since he had known him, the other smiled.
I can quite understand you being irritated, Mr. Chertsey. My name, he added, is Sir Harker Bellamy, and I am departmental chief of the British Intelligence Department.
Chertsey became penitent. I say, he stammered, forgive me for being such a fool. I might have known.
There is sufficient reason why Robert Baintree's death and everything connected with it should not be talked about. The essential quality about our work is its secrecy. I should not have said as much, Mr. Chertsey, if circumstances had not brought you into this business. And now, I'll wish you good night.
Chertsey motioned to an easy chair by the side of the glowing fire. Can't you stay a few more minutes, sir? Just long enough to smoke a cigarette? I rather wanted to ask you a favor.
The expression of Sir Harker Bellamy was noncommittal as he tapped the cigarette he had taken from the cedarwood box. Chertsey was nervous.
What I am going to say may sound very ridiculous, he started, but I should like to be allowed to take a hand, if it is at all possible, in trying to solve the mystery of Robert Baintree's death. A man cannot have such an experience as I had 2 nights ago without feeling it. As you have said yourself, circumstances brought me into the affair. They brought me into it against my will, it's true, but once in, I should like to stay in.
The only sign the other made was to flick the ash off his cigarette. It was not encouraging, but Chertsey went on.
I don't mind confessing that my motive is not an entirely unselfish one. For months I have been fed up with the commonplace, ordinary existence, ordinary travel, but there was something so dastardly about Baintree's death that I should welcome the chance, for its own sake as it were, to get a hand on that beastly murderer. I'm expressing myself damn badly, I know, but...
Bellamy rose and flung his cigarette stub into the fire.
Better stick to your novel writing, Chertsey, he said.
Does that mean...
It means that novel writing is considerably safer.
I speak 4 languages, I am very fit.
Good night.
Sorry.
Grimface was gone.
To every man at times comes a dangerous mood. One is inclined then to break with the settled order of ordinary existence. Life becomes stale and pallid. Whatever tang it may once have held is gone. It is this chafing which sends some men into the divorce court, others into Africa to shoot lions. A week before Chertsey had entered the open door of Robert Baintree's flat in Half Moon Street, he had crossed from New York in the Berengaria. The sea had upset him, made him restless. He had bought a number of novels at Brentano's in 5th Avenue the last afternoon, but he had found it impossible to read one of them. Concentration of any sort was out of the question. He just loafed, and he found even this fretting to the nerves. He could have flirted, of course, but none of the would-be amorette, whether married, single or widows, appealed. Even intense boredom, or whatever it was which was making him irritable, was preferable to an insipid love affair. His mood of discontent became intensified during the first week in London. Usually he returned from a cross-Atlantic trip with a sense of renewed vigour and fresh interest. Now, he would say to himself as he stepped back into his comfortable study, for some work. But although the story he was on had been promised for an early date, he could not bring himself to write more than a few paragraphs a day. The fatal inability to concentrate still dogged him. Writing novels suddenly seemed a ridiculous and absurd occupation. Then he had stepped across the threshold of a door and found himself face to face with something real, vital, dynamic, life with the lid off. But Grimface had turned him down cold. His mood had not improved by the experience. There was the usual pile of letters on the breakfast table, but he pushed them aside whilst he had his meal. Then, gathering them up, he crossed to the wide fireplace, lowered himself into a worn Morocco chair, and filled and lit a pipe. The mood of irritability was rather worse that morning. The memory of the talk with Grimface the night before was very vivid, and Chertsey's perusal of his mail was marked by a series of short explosions. He was not a mean or selfish man, but he wished these charity mongers would leave him alone for a bit. Then there were the immaculately typed envelopes which, upon being opened, proved to contain the compliments of Samuel MacJacob and his tribe, who, upon note of hand alone, were prepared to advance any sum up to £25,000. Another, this from the editor of a monthly magazine.
Dear Chertsey, I want to start that serial. Where the deuce is it? Yours sincerely, John Bezant.
The reader groaned. He was sick of work.
The last envelope of the batch was small and azure-coloured. A faint fragrance drifted to him as he picked it up. He viewed it curiously for a minute. The writing was not familiar, and it had been addressed to him CO his English publishers. He tore the flap.
"Dear Mr. Chertsey, I hope you won't think me too much of an abandoned female if I write to say how much I enjoyed your last book. I have read them all. They are my favourite bedtime literature, as a matter of fact, but the lure beats all the rest. I hope you are not too hopelessly conventional. Judging from the kind of stuff you write, I should not imagine you were. If you feel capable of such a rash act, let me offer you some tea one afternoon. This is not an entirely disinterested invitation, I warn you. I want your autograph in some of my favourite novels. You might ring me up if you think anything about it. Sincerely yours, Sophie Laurent."
His worst enemy could not have said that Chertsey had many illusions about himself. He was fast advancing towards the unromantic 40s. He was only moderately good-looking, and he regarded his novels mainly as a means of livelihood. It was necessary that he should make money somehow, and writing appealed to him as the easiest way he knew. Contrary to the average experience, he had sold his stuff from the start, and as time went on, he got better and better prices for it. He was fond of change, and he could work whilst he travelled. He might have become conceited. His novels contained nothing of sex, and yet all classes appeared to read them. In the Berengaria library list, there was a long row of them, and the library steward said they were always out. In the ordinary way, he would probably have ignored the letter and concentrated on the business-like epistle of the editor of the Centurion magazine. That meant something practical. English magazines paid badly compared to American ones, but he had got Besant up to £1,000 for the serial rights of the Midnight Club, and what was even more important, directly he delivered the manuscript, he could receive his money. But when he looked through the open door into his study, which adjoined, and saw the typewriter waiting, he reached out for the telephone. Holding the letter signed Sophie Laurent, he asked for a number.
"So you have been bored? We must see to that."
Chertsey watched through the cigarette smoke, her eyes quizzing him. "I am no longer bored," he said. She reached out for a fresh cigarette from the jade box, and he sprang up rather awkwardly, for the Chesterfield was deep, to strike a match. As he held the flame cupped, the girl's fingers touched the back of his hand. A gleam of amusement was in her eyes, which held a deeper challenge.
"It was very good of you to come."
"I hope you are not too disappointed."
"On the contrary,"
she smiled again.
"It would, I confess, have been a terrible blow if you had proved to be a fat, bearded person with a large family."
"Many of my tribe are just like that."
"Really? Then the beautiful emotions they express are nothing more than their secret longings and desires."
"Probably. But what would you have done had I turned up with a beard and a family portrait album?"
"Given you tea, of course, got your signature to my books, and then discovered an acute headache. As it is..."
She gestured with her free hand. "I'm flattered and grateful."
"Thank you. This is rather jolly, don't you think?"
She motioned again with a white, ringless hand, exceptionally groomed. The movement was comprehensive. It embraced the glowing fire, the corner of the room in which they were entrenched, the Chesterfield on which they were both seated, and her visitor. It was evidently intended as a compliment. Chertsey, soothed by his surroundings, accepted it as such. For the speaker was by no means ordinary. On the contrary, she was distinctly unusual. Sophie Laurent was not beautiful in the orthodox, stereotyped fashion. Her mouth was too large and her features too irregular for that. But she was a striking type, nevertheless. Her body had an attractive suppleness, and its grace was shown off to advantage by the afternoon gown she wore. She had a personality, and it was compelling. Chertsey found himself becoming more and more interested, almost fascinated. This woman, he put her age down at 26 or so, was intensely alive. The movements of her body, the animation of her voice and glance, the play of her hands showed it. He liked people to be alive. They drifted into more or less intimate talk. The girl had let the barriers down, and Chertsey, never a slave to convention, willingly stepped over the threshold. She told him that she was alone in London, that, although possessed of sufficient private means, she was herself oftentimes bored, and...
"You don't think me too dreadful for writing you, I hope, old chap?"
she asked. Her outstretched hand picked a speck of dust off his shoulder.
"I've never done such a thing before, but there's something in your work which thrills me. Is it the way you make your heroines behave, or what?"
"My dear, you overwhelm me," he replied.
"Not at all. I mean it. Tell me... have you had many adventures yourself?"
He looked at her. She was extremely attractive, with the firelight playing on her white, opulent skin. Amorous or otherwise?
Otherwise, of course. You don't think I've lured you here in order to get details of your dreadful past? No, what I mean is, you describe action so well in your books that I always feel you must have actually taken part in something of the sort yourself. I should like you to have met a very great friend of mine. He's dead now, but Bob Baintree.
You knew Baintree? His surprise made him interrupt. She regarded him with astonishment.
Do you mean to say you were a friend of his too? But how extraordinary.
I saw him once, that's all. Some intuitive feeling, he could not tell what instinct it was which guided him, made him temporize. She nodded.
He died a couple of days ago, quite suddenly and rather mysteriously. When I say mysteriously, I mean that it seems strange to think of a man in the prime of life and as strong as he was dying at all, and no one seems to know what it was that struck him down.
Into the listener's mind flashed a picture. Chertsey saw that still form with the grotesquely limp limbs lying on the blue patterned carpets with the blood staining the shirt front. Should he tell this girl what he knew? He decided not. Evidently she was ignorant of the truth, and it might cruelly distress her.
My feelings for poor Bob were never more than those of a friend, a very dear friend, but he always said he was very much in love with me. He wrote me the most wonderful letters. The night before his death he called here. It was rather a painful scene we had. You see, he asked me once again to marry him, and I refused. He was a dear, and I liked him awfully, but it's absolutely suicidal to marry anyone you do not love, don't you think?
I should imagine so.
It was then I gave him back his letters. I felt I no longer had the right to them. I fancy I can see his face now.
She shivered slightly, although the room was very hot.
As he put them away in a black leather case, it's hateful to think that prying eyes may read the words which must have been sacred to him.
Chertsey leaned forward. You would like to have those letters back? He asked.
Only to destroy them, now that Bob is dead. Perhaps you can understand.
Of course, but if the letters are addressed to you, they are your property. Mr. Baintree's executors would deliver them up to you if you made application.
Oh, but I have written and received no reply. Do you know what I think?
What?
I have the idea, although Bob never told me, great friends as we were, that he was engaged on some private work for the government. That would explain the secrecy which has so surrounded his death. It might also explain why I cannot get my letters returned. Being a woman, I feel so helpless.
She paused, biting her lower lip.
Then there is another possibility. They may have been stolen. There is the chance of blackmail.
It was obviously up to Chertsey. If I can do anything, he started. She turned to him so impulsively that one rounded arm encircled his neck.
Will you? Thank you. I know where the letters were put. If only you could find that black leather case.
The red lips were parted. Her eyes sent forth an invitation. But strangely enough, when Chertsey found himself 5 minutes later out on the Earl's Court pavement, it was not of the woman he had just left that he thought. His mind dwelt on the still form of a man lying on the floor of his flat, brutally murdered. A month passed. It was during this month that Gilbert Chertsey's friends went round inquiring of each other what the deuce had happened to him. On the principle of going to the fountainhead, Ringwood, who was really anxious, rang up the novelist's literary agent. "Don't ask me," replied that harassed individual. "All I know is that he won't work and that he spends all his time with some woman. No, I don't know anything more than that. I can't tell you her name, but she's got him all right. They're inseparable. I saw them lunching at the Savoy yesterday, and when I reminded Chertsey that he was already 2 months behind with his new novel, he nearly bit my head off. Yes, he's either mad or is going to get married. Bye." Chertsey adjusted the gold-rimmed spectacles of plain glass, fingered the small moustache glued to his upper lip by spirit gum, and walked on. It was difficult to believe that he was in London, even in the noisome East End. This dark, fetid alley was more in keeping with the underworld of some foreign capital. It was so dark that he could scarcely see his hand in front of him. Dread struck him. He might not be able to find the place again. He had been there only once before, and he had to find it. He stumbled on until he reached the end of this unsavory alley. A turn to the right brought him more light and a clearer knowledge of his surroundings. He was in a street now, a street lined with grimy-looking houses that frowned evilly upon the few persons walking furtively upon the pavement below. Into one of these houses he turned, watched by many curious eyes. Up the rickety staircase he climbed until he reached a door on the third floor. He thrust this open without the preliminary of knocking. For such a house, it was a surprisingly comfortable room. At a big desk, placed against the farther wall, a girl sat writing. As the door opened, she swung round in her chair.
"Yes?"
she demanded. Her right hand was in a pocket of her skirt. "Don't trouble to shoot, Sophie," said Chertsey. The girl stared incredulously, and then tilted back her head. There was relief and something else in her laugh.
"You're a wonderful old thing," she declared. "But why the disguise?"
Chertsey turned to lock the door.
"Yes, I should have done that. It was very careless of me. I don't know what Philip would say."
Her tone changed.
"By the way, he should be here. It's not like him to be late. You haven't seen him?"
"No, but I've heard about him." Her expression changed as she saw the look in his eyes.
"What do you mean? Has anything happened to him?"
"He's been taken." She opened her mouth to scream, but self-control asserted itself.
"How do you know? When did it happen? Philip, oh God, they'll hang him."
"Undoubtedly," Chertsey confirmed, but then he always knew they would. She passed over the singular remark in her urgent desire for further information.
"When did it happen?"
"He was arrested an hour ago in the California Hotel in Leicester Square." She came closer.
"Gilbert, how do you know this?"
"Ever since the night of Baintree's death, I have been shadowed, under suspicion." She caught his arm.
"That has been through me. Oh, my dear, they will not touch you. Is that why you came here disguised?"
He disregarded her question and continued. "I thought two could play at that game, and so I did a bit of spying back. That is how I knew of your brother's arrest." He freed his arm from her hand. "I came straight here to warn you. They know that your brother had a woman working with him, although they have the murderer of Baintree." He wondered she did not notice the hardening of his voice. "They will not be satisfied. I have heard of this man Bellamy. He's a tiger, and he will not rest until he has got you as well. He must know all about you by this time." It seemed incredible that she did not suspect him, but the girl remained calm, almost impassive. Was she stunned by grief? He went on hurriedly. "They may be here any moment. This place can be traced now they have O'Donnell." She just smiled. It was pathetic.
"I do not care," she said. "Let them come."
Chertsey caught her by the shoulders. "You don't realize what you are saying, Sophie. Through O'Donnell, there may be the clearest evidence against you. Although England is not at war, the country cannot afford to be sentimental against agents working for a foreign power which is known to be hostile. Don't you realize the risk?"
"I have taken a greater risk than that, and lost."
"A greater risk?" He was puzzled.
"When I endeavored to make you love me, Gilbert."
She sat down again at the big desk at which she had plotted so brilliantly against the country which was giving her hospitality.
"I, who had sworn to steel my heart against all emotion, have lamentably failed. That is why I do not care what the future may hold."
Chertsey kept silent because he did not know what to say. He had played the traitor to this girl who had trusted him, and the reflection was not pleasant. He had encouraged her to love him, and now this love, unless she got away, might mean her death.
"This is the end, and I do not care,"
continued Sophie Leroy.
"You know part of my story. I will be very brief with the rest. I am Irish. My father was killed, butchered is the better word, by those licensed murderers known as the Black and Tans in 1920. I had just left the convent then. Philip, my half-brother, had sworn vengeance against England, the employer of my father's murderers, and he persuaded me to join him in his work. He soon found a way."
"Russia." There was contempt in Chertsey's inquiry. She shrugged her beautiful shoulders.
"Why did it matter for whom we worked?"
she said wearily.
"Germany, France, Italy, it would all have been the same. We were out for vengeance, not money. Neither Philip nor I ever received a penny."
Chertsey shifted in his chair. She paid no attention.
"Philip had no special personal animosity against Robert Baintree, but Baintree was the most dangerous member of the special branch of the Secret Service working against us. He had collected certain information."
"Which was in the black leather case?"
"Yes, it was just a forlorn hope asking you to try to get it back."
"It was already in the hands of Scotland Yard. I took it to them on the morning after the murder." She showed no surprise.
"I guessed it all along, but I would not allow myself to believe it true. Then it was you who betrayed Philip?"
Chertsey nodded. "It was I. When I saw the dead body of Baintree, I swore I would bring his murderer to justice. I asked Sir Harker Bellamy to let me join his staff. He curtly refused, and so I worked on my own. We have been on different sides, Sophie. The luck of the game. I happen to have won."
"Yes, Gilbert, you've won. You've been true to your principles, but I have been false, a traitress. If Philip knew, he would curse me with his dying breath.
She stopped to bite her lip.
I have no desire to escape, because I realize that you do not care sufficiently to go with me. So I will stay until Sahaka Bellamy and your other friends come. You can hand me over to them yourself. It will be a further triumph for you.
He passed her jibe by. To the best of my knowledge, they do not know of this address. They have not learned it through me, but Philip may have papers on him.
By rights, I should kill you, but God help me, I love you. I started out to make a fool of you, but it is I who am the fool. Gilbert, have you no pity for me? See to what depths I have sunk.
A maddening desire to crush her to him, to take all that she was prepared out of her love to offer, almost overwhelmed him. But between him and the temptation rose the never-to-be-forgotten picture, the image of a murdered man. We are on different sides, my dear, he replied.
But listen to me. God, how shameless I am. I will throw up the work.
There was a peremptory knock on the door. He rushed to her. Quickly, isn't there another way out? A secret exit. You must go.
No, let them take me. Nothing matters now. You have won.
Open this door,
called a strident voice. I love you, lied Chertsey. I will join you in Paris.
You swear that?
I swear it. She pressed a hidden spring beneath the big desk and the wall fell apart. Into this opening, after snatching up hat and coat, she stepped.
Gilbert,
go,
he ordered. The panel had scarcely swung to before the door of the room crashed open. A number of men rushed in. At their head was Sahaka Bellamy.
Arrest that man, he ordered.
Chertsey tore off the false moustache and removed the plain glass spectacles.
Chertsey, what in the devil are you doing here?
Clearing up. I understand you have arrested a man named Philip O'Donnell for the murder of Robert Baintree. You did so on the strength of an anonymous typewritten communication supplied by me.
By you?
It's rather a long story, but when you turned me down, I resolved to find Baintree's murderer on my own. Luck was on my side.
How?
The circumstances are personal, and I do not propose to explain them. Bellamy came back to the essentials.
O'Donnell worked with a woman named Sophie Leroy. She was his half-sister. She was the brains of this outfit, and we want her. Where is she?
How should I know?
No, of course you know. You've been constantly in her company for weeks. I'm serious, Chertsey, and you had better understand it. Even now, I'm not certain that you're not mixed up in this poisonous business yourself. We know this to be the hiding place of O'Donnell. The woman can't be far away.
Chertsey shrugged with as much ostentation as he could contrive. Since you are so well informed, find her.
I know this much. The woman, Sophie Leroy, fooled you to the top of her bent, and perhaps made a traitor out of an honest man. Stand back. Stevenson, see that crack in the wall by the side of the desk? If you don't stand aside, Chertsey, I swear I'll shoot.
Don't be a fool, Bellamy.
Stand aside.
From the other side of the wall came a voice, clear if unsteady.
Gilbert, goodbye.
Then a revolver shot filled the room with sinister sound.